This is the Linksys for Me Too podcast series with Gregor Ross and Andy Wallace. Okay, welcome to another From Me Too podcast. I'm here with Gregor Ross, co-founder of Linksys. And the From Me Too podcast really looks into the lives of successful people and how their background, their upbringing, their experience has really led them to strive to be the entrepreneurs that they are and into the experts in their field. So we're very thrilled to have Tim Baines from Compatio AI with us today. He's the CEO and founder of Compatio, and you've got 3 decades of experience in CPQ, which is configure, price and quote systems, and configuration management. But Tim's really now taking CPQ beyond or to another level in the form of guided selling, and also adding a bit of real intelligence, if you like, behind the logic that drives those types of systems. So we're really pleased to have you with us today, Tim.
Yeah, great to be here, Andy and Gregor.
Good stuff.
So as usual, Tim, what we're going to do is we're going to go back to the beginning. So if it's okay with you, can you talk about your upbringing, where you lived? I know from conversations before that you're involved with family business. So if you just spend a few minutes, give us a bit of where you've came from.
Yeah, sure. So I was brought up in Ohio, mainly in the town of Dayton, which you may know as the birthplace of aviation, at least according to the Americans.
Yeah.
And very... a lot of deep industrial base there, a lot of manufacturing in that area, especially at that time. My father owned a metal fabrication company, kind of semi-production. We did a lot of machine shop type work, but then we also had a number of sort of larger scale contracts that we delivered, mainly to the Department of Defense. We produced ammunition racks for tanks. We had a beryllium shop, and we machined made the brake discs for the space shuttle and the C-5A and the F-16, if I remember right. So a lot of metalworking. While I was there, I worked for my father from age 15 to probably 23 or 24, learned to TIG weld, became a TIG welder, did mainly a lot of aluminum welding, which is a little challenging. My father's company got bought out by another company that was a subsidiary of General Electric, their jet engine manufacturing division. So when we got bought out, I ended up getting trained in dealing in welding Inconel, which is a high strength, low weight alloy used in aircraft manufacture. So ended up welding Inconel products. And I really loved to weld. But as I got a lot of experience sort of learning how that level of industrial manufacturing happened. So we'll probably have a chance to talk more about that.
And did you like the engineering side, the making of things?
I did. Love the hands-on work.
Did you know that right away, or was that already?
No, I knew it right away. Yeah. I was always kind of hands-on. I like to build things and, partially or restored a guitar that I had to partially rebuild when I was probably age 12 or 13, if I remember right. And got a shotgun when I was 8 or 9 years old, and I rebuilt that and refinished it. So I always like doing those kinds of hands-on things. And when I started welding, I mean, I knew I loved welding right from day one. Yeah. I learned it at high school a little bit, because we had a shop class where I learned it stick and mainly, MIG in high school, but I loved it right away. Loved it.
I suppose that was your first foray into sort of problem solving and seeing where that could lead in terms of success. And
yeah, I was always very inventive. I always had an idea for how to do things better. Not necessarily processes, but actual products. So I was always looking for ways to Or acquiring the skills, let's say, to be able to implement the ideas that were coming out of my head. I felt like that kind of defined who I was when I was a teenager, was that inventiveness and that wanting to build things.
In terms of your, you know, take us through your education. So you spent time at your father's business. You then went to university and then on to Klein Associates to look at a researching expert decision making with high stakes. I'm really intrigued to learn more about that, how, you know, your studies and then your time at Klein.
Yeah, well, at my dad's company, somewhere in the late 70s, he installed an industrial robotic welder. And I very quickly learned how efficient that could be. We bought it for a specific job, which was to produce the very large bearing rings that sat in the turret of the Humvee vehicle. And it was able to pay for itself in about 3 months with the amount of production that it had. And so I got very interested in automated processes at that point. And around that same time, PCs started showing up. I had access to one at work that I started playing with, and I got very interested in computers. They immediately appealed to me because of your ability to essentially build something automated, watch it run, see if it works, tweak it if you need to, and get something really interesting done. And so I was fascinated by computers immediately. However, in college, I was majoring in psychology, but I sort of gravitated towards the cognitive side. And, you know, I learned there was a whole field called cognitive science, which was emerging around that time, which is sort of a cognitive science was multidisciplinary, kind of drew on any field that had something to say about how people think and how they reason. So it sort of synergized computer science, psychology, cognitive psychology, other fields, including neurophysiology and neurocognition and all those. And drew on the physical side as well, the biological side as well. So in school, although I was a psych major, I started picking up a lot of computer science classes, and I sort of saw myself as becoming a cognitive scientist, had an opportunity to go to work for Klein Associates, which at that time was Human Factors. It was a research firm with, I think, 8 or 10 PhD cognitive psychologists or human factors psychologists. There were probably 20 to 25 people in the firm all told. And Klein focused on expert decision making. They had a number of research contracts, largely funded by Department of Defense money, who were very interested, Department of Defense, the Armed Services, Air Force, Navy, Army, were very interested in understanding how to optimize human decision-making, especially under conditions of high stress, like in a war. Yeah. So they were willing to spend quite a bit of money and understanding that better. There were some corporate funding as well, but I think the bulk of our funding was DOD. We did some fascinating studies having to do with expert decision-making. I was involved personally in a project that lasted maybe a year and a half, if I recall. It's been a while now. Again, sort of understanding expert decision-making under conditions of high stress, high stakes. There weren't any good wars going on at the time, thank goodness. So we chose to focus on firefighters, expert firefighters. We ended up interviewing highly experienced, I'm talking 20-year-plus captain level or above mm-hmm. firefighters who had been through very, very significant events in their career. And so we conducted a study where we sort of reconstructed the event by interviewing them. And we had an artist render paintings or drawing, colored drawings of fire ground scenes. And we would ask the fire ground commander that we were interviewing to tell us what were they looking at in the scene that helped them understand what was actually going on. And at the time, Gary Klein, the head of the firm, was working very, very closely with Tversky and Kahneman, who were experts already in this field of expert decision making. And together with Gary and Tversky and Kahneman, they had come up with this theory of tacit knowledge. And tacit knowledge is knowledge that you don't know that you have. You know, it helps you, it sort of underpins your thinking and your perceptions of a situation, a scenario. And are essentially in conducting this study, we had a series of interview techniques that we had evolved over time that helped us help the expert sort of dive down and become aware of knowledge that they didn't even know that they had, this tacit knowledge. So the study all really helped us refine those techniques, but also helped us really prove out this idea that tacit knowledge was real, number one, and that it had a strong impact on how human experts behave, and that it was essentially almost always present when, if you are an expert in your field and you've been practicing in that field for 10 or 20 or 30 years, that much of your knowledge actually does become tacit. You don't even know what you know anymore, but we can bring it out. We can discover it by asking you to tell us what cues you're paying attention to, and then to unpack what those cues mean to you, we can sort of uncover that tacit knowledge. So it was a fascinating study, fascinating series of projects that we did there. But it launched me very firmly on my path to really be interested in knowledge management, knowledge engineering, and how that related to cognitive science and AI ultimately.
Yeah, because it's quite an interesting mix. So you've been at your father's business. You like the practical, you enjoy the engineering, but then the deep dive you've just went through there in terms of behavioral, putting those things together, it seems like you yourself really enjoy both.
I do, yeah.
Whereas you would sometimes, you know, there's more practical in the engineering, the science, the doctor side, the maybe sitting in a room and learning all the time. And it maybe feels, is that the start, is that the foundation of everything that's come after? Or is where you still, by that point, did you know what you wanted next in terms of career?
Yeah, I still wasn't totally clear on where I wanted to go next. I applied to several graduate programs, and I sort of hedged my bets by applying to both cognitive psychology and neuropsychology programs, which are quite different, by the way. One's medical, one's not.
Yeah, definitely.
And I had an opportunity to go down the neuro path, but at the same time, there was this other current, this other thread in my life that had to do with running a business and all of the challenges that you have as the owner or manager of a business, just to kind of step back one step. At my father's company, as the son of the owner, I, you know, obviously could internalize or had internalized his perspective, but yet I was out there on the floor as a welder. So just out there among the rank and file. So I could see both perspectives. Yep. And so the challenges that I witnessed and some of the you know, working through some of the issues that we had with quality or production or whatever, it made it kind of sensitized me to the need to understand how to build a company that would run smoothly and achieve its goals. So I got sort of, from out of all that, I got very interested in organizational theory and organizational behavior. So I had this cognitive science track, but I also had this organizational theory track as well that I was mentally following. So when I applied to programs in graduate school, I applied to both. I applied to organizational behavior as well as this cognitive neuro type of programs. And I ended up having an offer to go to Cornell in the School of Industrial Labor Relations in an organizational behavior program, which I ended up taking that offer and ended up at Cornell studying that.
So, I mean, these skills you're hearing, they're all building blocks to where you are with Compatio. And even listening to you there about the tacit knowledge, what you're trying to do with the Compatio system is unlock that knowledge for others that don't have it. And I will come to more of that. But it's actually interesting hearing how that early life and the theory and everything you're fully understanding in order to be the foundation to enact this real intelligence that we'll hear more about as we move forward.
So in terms of, I was in the computer industry in the 90s with Compaq, and the 90s were really interesting because that's all went from talking about the features and the hard drives to Steve Jobs and Apple and talking about the benefits. So thinking about some of the large companies you work for, can you take us through some of the organizations and how the 90s were for you? Because I take it that would be the main thrust of the start of working with corporates and being in the IT world.
Yeah. So what was most significant about my time at Cornell, to touch on that for just a moment, is as part of my master's research, I ended up participating in a project with Xerox Corporation they were collaborating with the Cornell University Libraries, building a digital scanning system, a state-of-the-art digital scanning system to solve the brittle books problem, right? At that time, 1991 or thereabouts, 91, 92, there was a sort of a crisis that was hitting our libraries. All the books, or many of the books, had been printed on acid-based paper a few decades earlier, and they were crumbling to dust before our eyes. So it was kind of a national emergency, nearly, to solve that problem. So I followed this team of engineers from Xerox as they were working with the Cornell librarians, the archival librarians, to build this scanning system. And it was controlled by a personal computer running this product called Windows from Microsoft, which at that time was in a 2.2.x version. Fairly challenging to program and develop. And it was on that project that as a social scientist at that time, in studying organizational behavior, as I started working with these software engineers, I went native, as we say in the social sciences, and ended up deciding that the computing was so much more interesting than anything else that I was involved with. So I just ended up throwing myself into computing right around that time. And I ended up we moved back to Ohio from New York State, where Cornell is, went back to Ohio where we're from, my wife and I, and I ended up working for a Fortune 500 company called Reynolds & Reynolds. That was really my first IT job, so to speak. And it was there, working in the IT department, we had a new project that came through. We needed to automate our sales processes. And they decided to buy a configurator, a product configurator, and set that up for use by our sales team to sell. I was part of the automotive systems division at Reynolds & Reynolds. They sold software, essentially a turnkey system that ran automotive dealerships. So every function that you needed to run, inventory control, purchasing contracts, body shop estimating, you know, selling insurance to the customer. I mean, everything that the dealer needed was on these systems, from Reynolds and Reynolds. And, they wanted us to build a configurator that our sales team could use out in the field to, configure, quote, propose these, you know, very expensive systems for dealers. That was my first real project involving configurators. I was dragged into it, kicking and screaming. I didn't want to do it. I was concerned. This was about 1995, I guess, right in that period. And I was very concerned about having to learn a proprietary language that was part of that configurator. I was worried that I would get stuck maintaining that system and I'd be there for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And that isn't what happened. After a few months, I had a call from KPMG, who somehow learned that I had this skill with configurators, and ended up going to work for them to build a configurator practice in the mid-90s.
So this is where we start to ring off quite a lot of
notes. Yeah, as you said, there's a very large KPMG, as you said, BearPoint, Oracle, Configit, and Gartner. I mean, they're really sort of blue chip names in that field. And so, I mean, what are your most important insights from that journey? And you'll have seen CPQ evolve, and then now we're in the world of AI. So I mean, that we'll come to that. But I mean, what was your experience like? What insights did you take from those experiences?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was quite a journey. So we built the configurator practice at KPMG, I had a brief stint. During that time, we led configurator selection projects at some very, very large companies, Motorola, Cisco, some others that I can't even remember now. We developed really a selection methodology to guide companies through the process of choosing very expensive, complex software. For many of those projects, we also implemented the software at KPMG. So we had a really nice practice around that. But I also, during those 4 or so years that I was at KPMG, I ended up learning. It was trained on and certified on, I think, 5 or 6 different configurator systems. They weren't called CPQ back then. That name was off in the future still.
Yeah. What were they called?
Just configurators, product configurators. So I learned several different systems. It was clear then that challenges that I saw over and over that we weren't able to solve with that technology. As a result, I left KPMG in 2000 to launch my own company, configurator company. My timing wasn't very good because it was about 3 months before 9/11. As a startup, 9/11 hit and the world froze. Nobody did anything. Nobody met with anybody. So I had to pull the plug on that startup, which was called ConfigureNet. During my KPMG time, I had formed a pretty good relationship with the team at Oracle and Oracle's configurator product. And I knew most of the folks in product management and sales engineering for Oracle by that time. So ended up talking with Oracle when I went to work for Oracle related to their configurator project after I shut down ConfigureNet. So I spent the next 12-ish years at Oracle in Oracle's consulting group, leading configurator implementation projects for Oracle.
Before we get on to Compato, if you think about the corporates, the KPMGs, the Oracles, can you think of anything specifically, good points you learned from working in that size of organization, and maybe an example of a bad point or a failing you saw?
Yeah. A lot of it, I think, just has to do, a lot of it had to do with the number one, the challenges that these companies face in selling complex product. I mean, it's if you are a company that either has a large catalog of related products that go together to form a solution, a set of things that go together to satisfy the customer's needs, or they're build to order, they're configured to order products, that the complexity of that permeates essentially every single aspect of your business, from product engineering, product design, product engineering, product data management. How do you represent configurable product in your PLM or PIM? Into manufacturing, how do you set up your manufacturing operations, especially if you're global and you have multiple plants? How do you set it up to handle configurable product? An order comes in, it's got a configured product specified on it. You've got to go, you're not manufacturing 5 million widgets that all look the same. These are, each one is one off. Each one is built to order. You go to Ford, their website, you can order a Mustang and get it in, one of 10 colors and get, three different colors of seats and wheels and a radio and an engine. You have to specify that if you're going to configure a Mustang to order. Every one of those is built to order. And the managing that in terms of your supply chains, what you stock in inventory in your warehouse, and the routing through your manufacturing operations as you're building the product, those routings change depending on what it is that you're building. So it's just the complexity, and then that's just manufacturing. And then how do you sell it? How do you specify it? What do those systems look like? How do you book the order? And then how do you service the product when it's out in the field? It's unique. It's a one-off. How do you service that? So every single aspect of the company is touched. And so that, I think that was the single biggest lesson, is just how pervasive, how hard that problem actually is. But we also, again, ran into some of those issues that I ran into in the 90s didn't go away. And they had to do with product configuration is hard enough just when you manage it, manage it at the manufacturer level. But then it gets even more challenging out in the field downstream from the manufacturer, where you have contractors or integrators or dealers or distributors that deal with that problem all over again when they're trying to put a bunch of components together for multiple manufacturers, some of which are configurable in and of themselves. You try to combine all that into a solution, let's say a telecom solution or a material handling solution, or even a fluid handling situation, a plumbing system for an airport bathroom. The problem is five times as hard down there as it is back at the manufacturer. And those were the problems that I kept running into over and over, both back in the KPMG days as well as at Oracle. And it was those problems that caused me to launch Compatio.
Yeah. We'll come on to that a bit further, but I'm certainly hearing, if you just look at the evolution of mobile phones and technology, it's almost exponential. And I think in the world we're living in, people are demanding things much quicker. Yeah. And just hearing talking about all the various steps in a supply chain, if that was done just by humans and no computers, things were probably a bit more relaxed, but there was probably more humans to do it. Depending on which country you live in. Yeah. And I suppose you hear about people or companies, I should say, offshoring or onshoring skills. And I suppose configurators would help make things more efficient and be less reliant on technology, which is perhaps in certain economies, the older generation with the knowledge is retiring, and there's younger people. There's certainly pain points in business where they don't have the resource or the speed of learning to educate that resource. So you're actually, it's something that we shouldn't be scared of, is technology to help with those key decision makings and just very interested into more detail to understand that this is supply chain side of things. So, you know, I suppose we're at the point now where you've, you know, Compatio is born. So, you know, from all that experience, and maybe you can sort of share a bit more about how that's evolved.
Well, what was the coolest thing about working with configurators for me is that it bridged that very practical hands-on world where you need to understand the product and how it gets built. Sort of harkens back to the welding days where I had, you know, that on hand, you know, work with the products directly. It bridged sort of that world of manufacturing with computer science and also knowledge management. So it brought together sort of everything that I was interested in to build a configurator system. You have to have unless you're writing it from scratch, which I absolutely don't advise. I've seen a lot of those projects fail. So if you're going to implement a configurator system, you need to have a platform that's suitable, first of all, and I'll probably come back to that later. But assuming that you do have a suitable software platform, you have to go model the product that you're going to sell. If it's a something as simple as a commercial padlock, let's say, you have to represent all the different variations available. What are the different bodies, the different materials that are available for the body? What are the different kinds of shackles? What is their finish? How big are they? What's the size of the lock body? What's the keying system? Yeah. Is it going to be engraved? If so, what is the engraving? I went through a project with Master Lock where we configured those. And in order to go build out that configurator, you have to totally understand the product that is going to be specified, sold, and then manufactured, implementing a configurator draws on sort of that understanding of production in processes, but also you have to have the ability to go understand these many times incredibly complicated products, but you're working with a software system that allows you to encode knowledge. So you have to be able to think abstractly about that and go, you know, model sort of the options and questions that have to be answered, and then write the logic that governs how everything is going to go together to ensure that the configuration is correct. So all of that comes together when you're implementing a configurator. As I said, I was seeing these same challenges over and over with sort of state-of-the-art configurator systems that were unable to solve the problems that we would see down at the level of a distributor or an integrator, where virtually every configurator to this point has been targeted. They're sold to individual manufacturers. They configure that manufacturer's products for in build-to-order configuration. But what I was seeing over and over is, again, the need of an integrator or a distributor who needed to bring many products together from several manufacturers into a configured solution, a set of components from various places that come together. Like, think of a DSLR camera system. You know, you've got a camera body and a lens and a maybe flash and memory and a case and maybe a tripod, maybe even lights and backdrops and so forth. If you want a full studio setup, does it all go together? Does it suit the customer's actual needs? Well, somebody has to ask the right questions, number one, to understand their needs. And then the right products have to be recommended. And then those products all have to go together correctly. That's configuration. But there's also kind of a needs analysis, which we now call guided selling when it's on a computer. And so these are the problems that Compatio was intended to address from day one, this sort of down from the manufacturer out here in distributor world. We are and Compatio from day one was designed to be a build-to-order configurator, but we also wanted to solve this wider problem of cross-selling many components that go together. And so back to your question about expertise, Andy, what configurators do well is they encode product expertise. That's what they do. But it's product expertise applied specifically in most cases to build-to-order configuration. How do I make sure that Jaguar that I'm going to order, you know, will that color seats, is that color seats allowed to go with that color paint? And if you've got the V8 in it, what wheels are allowed? We don't want the 20-inch wheels. We can have the 21-inch wheels. Configurators implement that kind of logic. So that expertise or those policies of the company are embedded in a configurator. And that what configurators do is they take all those problematical decision points out of the hands of the person and put them in the system so you can get it right every time. That's what they do. And so they help ensure that the configuration is correct. So when it goes to manufacturing, you don't build yourself into a corner and end up trying to build something that technically won't work or will miss the customer's requirements entirely. And if you've got manual processes, people out putting these quotes together manually out in the field, there's inherent problems that can happen with that. So configurators solve that problem. So they are an answer to the problem of product expertise at the build to order level. Compatio is now the answer to product expertise sort of downstream from that manufacturer where it all comes together.
And then, I was just going to say, in terms of, we mentioned distributors and the challenge they have bringing different companies' products, but what we've been discussing, group companies that are perhaps on an acquisition trail, buying companies, they feel that there's a good mix of, this is why there's a good reason they've bought these companies and brought them together, but the sales teams are a bit siloed in what they understand, and they're maybe missing opportunities to benefit the group. And this is, you know, we've been terming it sort of revenue leakage. So, you know, could you share a bit of experience there and how Compatio can help with that, as well as further down the chain with distribution?
Yeah, absolutely. We see that the challenge of expertise happening in several ways right now. In some cases, it's the fact that you've got 30-year veterans that are now retiring, and all of that knowledge is walking out the door. Many of our customers are coming to us and telling us they have that problem.
Yeah.
That, same here, isn't it?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the sales expertise is retiring next year. Yeah. And it's, for any number of reasons, it's growing increasingly difficult to backfill that expertise in time. You got to hire the right people. It takes 10 years to become, at least 5 or 6 years, depending on the domain, up to 10 years to become sufficiently expert to know everything that you got to know. So you got to find the right people, you got to train them, and you got to keep them long enough that they become that expert before they go on to the next job. So we're seeing that everywhere, but we're also seeing it magnified several times over because of acquisitions and mergers and that type of growth, which we all know has become so common. There's so many roll-ups happening, PE companies, private equity companies, assembling sort of a family of brands that are meant to be complementary to one another. You know, the investor is thinking, you know, 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2. 1 + 1 should equal 3. I put these companies together and the value of that company is greater than the sum of its parts, right? But the problem is that, again, it's this problem of expertise. Each of those individual companies has its own experts. It's product managers, it's sales engineers, application engineers, or whatever, as well as oftentimes its own dealer network that are very familiar with the product, and they're confident, they're comfortable, they know what to recommend, they know how it all works. So they'll go out there and do sales all day long for that company's products. But now you've got these other brands, these other portfolio companies, their products that are now in the mix, and they don't have any idea how to sell them. They don't know how to match that to the customer's expertise. And they don't know, as they are especially missing opportunities to cross-sell. And it's in that cross-selling that 1 + 1 = 3 or even 4 or 5.
That's a key bit, the cross-selling, isn't it?
That's the key. Yeah, absolutely. I'm recommending this product. Customer wants this product, but hey, do you know we have these other products that go with it and complement it, or even satisfy a critical need that that product does not exist standalone? Do you know, it doesn't exist. That product cannot be used standalone. You can't just buy a DSLR camera body and get by with that. You need the lens, you need the flash, right? And so many of our customers in sort of industrial products, building materials, industrial automation, and so forth, all of these sectors have products that have to be used with other products. If you're going to install a custom door, well, that's nice, but you need the molding to go around it. You need, right? And and if the dealers know how to sell the door, but they don't have anything, they know nothing about the moldings that are over here, then you've just lost an opportunity to cross sell.
I think we've all done that.
Yeah.
Was it by the wrong things, the wrong configuration? Yeah. So cross selling's the main thing. That helps with group of companies, helps with revenue leakage, optimization. But I think at the heart as well, it's giving the customer confidence, and it's giving the company confidence that everything's happening properly, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's really nice. And then I guess thinking about that, the return on investment for the company, the group of companies, is just going to be amplified.
Yeah. Especially when you combine what we've been talking about, the ability to memorialize that sales expertise, not for one of the brands, but for all of the brands, and then define the mechanisms to ensure that the offer is made for the cross-sellable products, the complementary products, or in some cases, substitute products, alternate products. But you do that, and now you hook it up to analytics and the ability to optimize, which is what Compatio does. So we've been talking so far about very deterministic type things. Configurator rules are deterministic. They are usually mathematical or logical expressions that say, if you buy this, if you're going to include this option in the product, you have to have one of these options over here. Or if you choose this, you can't have these things over here. Those are very deterministic types of rules. There are certain things that you may want to, options that you may want to recommend in one market and not others. There are certain features of your product that sell well when you're selling to this industry. You're selling a power generator to backup power generators to a hospital. You may want to recommend certain features there that you would not recommend if you're selling a backup power generator to, let's say, an office complex. Yeah. Very different use cases. And what Compatio, we talked very early on about Compatio going beyond CPQ. Yeah. And that's exactly where we're going beyond, is not only do we have the ability to sell across many different brands, either at the manufacturer level, if you know, when you've got a portfolio of companies, or downstream at the contractor, integrator, distributor level, but we're doing that in a way where we collect all the analytics and optimize those offers that are being made at all times.
I think we had a discussion prior to recording the podcast, and what I found intriguing was that data is learning. They may have a set process which they believe are the right way to ask the questions, but you might find that some of these questions are not very efficient.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I found quite, a step forward in, configurators I've seen in the past. It's learning from that data.
Yeah.
And that's what you're just highlighting.
Yeah. This is obviously a rapidly evolving space, even for us. There are some parts of this that we do really well. There are other parts that we're discovering we need to get better at and do better. There's so many opportunities to optimize. Again, these are enormously complicated spaces that we're talking about, domains that we're talking about, and there's a million ways that you can find to do better. And we're on the path to help our customers figure out how to do all this a lot better.
Yeah. And it applies to all sectors if customers as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I'm very surprised at the flexibility of it. Like Gregor just said, it's almost like sector agnostic. I mean, you're going from, I know one of your passions, cycling, another one of your passions, fishing, right through to sort of construction, building products, automotive, and we've even been discussing finance and helping sort of configure finance packages. So it's really, it's amazing where it can fit, how it can benefit all businesses.
And another thing that's worth noting, so we only started Linksys last year, but we speak to our clients, we're networking, and we meet a lot of companies that mention AI, and the reality is, it's a buzzword for some. If what we love about Compatio and what we've discussed already is that really is embedded now in your product and in the company.
Yeah.
So I think that's definitely worth speaking about because that's been a journey as well the last couple of years, hasn't it?
It has been, so we're enormously excited about AI, obviously. It offers tremendous potential. However, we have to be very, very careful with it. And that's why at Compatio, we call what we do deterministic AI. There's the deterministic core that ensures that you get the solution right.
Yeah.
It's got intelligence. It has to be right. Yeah. It has to be. If you're going to recommend, a contactor, an electrical contactor to go with an electrical motor, a big electrical motor that's, and a set of fuses that are going to automate, a conveyor belt system in a factory, you have to get those recommendations right. If you don't recommend the right fuses, guess what? The circuit blows or something burns, you start a fire, that's bad. So you have to get it right. So we have that deterministic core that, and this is where AI, the LLMs and generative AI, can't be used yet to do what we do, because if it doesn't know the answer, it's going to make something up. You can't make this up. You have to nail it. So we've got that deterministic core, but yet it is wrapped in AI predictive so that we can optimize the recommendation for revenue or margin or conversion rates. We can ensure that it's the best recommendation, but it's the best recommendation from a set of equally valid recommendations that are technically correct. That's crucial.
Yeah. So just pulling from what you said there, I mean, the importance in regulated industries or where some things are compliance, and also talking about the versatility, it can be B2B, but it can also be B2C. Yeah. There might be through an e-commerce platform. So you're actually putting compliance in the hand of somebody that's on an e-commerce sort of platform, and therefore this is helping them be compliant and maybe take it, de-risking sales,
that's right,
I suppose, as well.
That's right.
So it's quite phenomenal.
So the journey so far with Compatio, what is it you're looking to achieve over the next 2 to 3 years, Tim?
Now the biggest change, the biggest challenge is handling the growth. We spent a few years getting the platform built out. It's obviously not a simple thing to build. Essentially encodes, multiple decades of experience. And then we spent a little, the COVID didn't help us. We were in a consumer sector at that time. The problem at that point was not selling more, which we help a company do at that time in COVID. It was getting inventory, right?
Yeah.
Which we didn't help with. So we had some headwinds during COVID, but as the platform strengthened, as we've continued to develop it over the years, we've been able to get into progressively more and more complex industries. So industrial automation, building materials, commercial water handling, plumbing fixtures, and so forth. As we've been able to take on more and more complex challenges, we've sort of found our fit with these industrial companies. Building construction, B2B, is really where the critical need is. And now, again, we have, frankly, more more sales opportunities that we can deal with right now. So that's now the challenge, is to make sure we can get to all of the potential customers and deliver.
Good place to be.
Yes, it is. It is. It's a good problem to have.
And you're global?
Yes, we are. Yes, yep. We are selling in, well, we mostly, let's say, a couple, we cover, we sell in North America as well as Europe, and we're just beginning to spin up the Middle East and India.
And you've got a good team?
Yes, we do. We have a very, very good team.
Yeah, have they enjoyed so far the work we've been doing in a small way together?
Yes, it's been really exciting for Lixis to be collaborating with you and hopefully developing a piece on the revenue leakage and the ability for companies to maximize cross-selling. So we're looking forward to developing that further with you and see where that takes us.
Yeah, as are we. So we're really excited about the opportunity to partner with you guys. These are not complex problems, and they're not complex. They're complex problems, and they're complex solutions. And I think you need to be smart about understanding the customer's needs, and then knowing what to recommend to them, even for our system. And so, I think having you guys be able to help to get those doors open and tee up the solution is very exciting for us.
Yeah, we feel the same. It's been a pleasure. So just to wrap up this part then, we're going to finish off with a few more fun, quick questions. But if you think about your journey, starting with the work with the family and your father, everything you've achieved with the corporates, the false start with your own business, and now the success and the growth ongoing with Compatio, do you feel there's a legacy there to what you've done? If you take a moment, do you think about what you're maybe most proud of?
Yeah, there is. Thank you. It's a good question. And, whenever I think about questions like this, I mean, I always think about the people first and foremost. I had a blast at KPMG, had a great group of colleagues who are still my friends today. We solved some really hard problems and created significant value for our customers. Then going on to Oracle, again, made a number of good friends there and friends that I still know and talk to today once again. And again, delivering really interesting solutions for really hard problems that really created value. I mean, these are, you know, we're making it easier to buy or sell products that underpin everything that we do, you know, plumbing or automation or automotive or whatever. So I think we're doing some real good in the world in making this all flow a lot more smoothly. But I'm also really, I think I'm most proud of what we built at Compatio so far. I mean, we still got a long ways to go because to achieve the full vision, but we've got an amazing team between the U.S. and we own our own subsidiary in India where we do a lot of the product engineering. Love working with that team. Love going to visit and sitting down and brainstorming with them. We've gotten an awful lot done, and we've just some of the things that we've overcome and solved so far have just been mind-boggling. So really most proud of where we are right now. And as you know, it's very hard to launch a company. It's even harder to keep the company going long enough to see success.
Yeah. Always harder than you think.
Yes. Always harder.
Things take longer.
Everything. You have to build every single thing from scratch. Everything. And so that's obviously been, a hard journey, but it's been very satisfying. I mean, as the CEO, you essentially solve one problem at a time, you get it solved. And once you solve enough of those problems, lo and behold, you have a successful company.
Yeah. Well, we think you're in a really great place. We love the work we're doing together, but more important, we think you're a great individual. And the last hour or so, speaking about career, has been fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that. So, Tim, don't be scared. This is a session.
This is the fun part.
Yeah, it's called Off the Cuff.
Off the Cuff.
Off the Cuff. And that, just as it sounds, quick fire questions. Don't think too much about the answers. Don't try to configure an answer. Just come straight with it. Then that's it. So, Gregor, do you want to fire off for the first one?
I'll go first. Yeah. Late or fashionably early?
Late.
I have to say, we've witnessed one or two.
Yes. Like that answer.
Yeah. I did like that. Your answer was correct.
That is no surprise to anybody that knows me.
Lotus.
Maybe this is relevant. Best habit and worst habit.
Mm-hmm.
Best habit. Ensuring that we do it right rather than hacking something out. Worst habit is, boy, that's probably a better question for my wife.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But
who we've got on the phone?
Probably it is living in my own time zone. Making sure that I'm on my time clock is synced with the world's, because usually it's not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you could take a day out of the week and replace it with a second Saturday, what day goes?
That's interesting. I would say it'd have to be Monday. Yeah. An even longer weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. Length of sentence.
Good answer.
That way you've got time to really dive into something meaningful.
Yeah. You mentioned travel there, or time zones anyway. So train, plane, or automobile?
Oh, that one's obvious. Train all the way.
Is it?
Train all the way.
Even although you were in the sweet spot of aviation.
Yeah, you know, well. So now that's a different kind of question. So if I could have any car that I wanted, or I'm flying my own plane, then it's definitely some sports car, and or my plane. But if I had to choose between commercial air travel, or driving just some car, or riding the train, I'll take the train every day.
Well done.
And I'm glad I took the train up here to Edinburgh.
Yeah, fantastic.
It's a lovely journey.
If you could outsource one daily task forever, what would that be?
One daily task forever. If I could outsource it, I would say probably having a really nice meal delivered to where I sit.
It's a good answer.
That's a good
answer. I like that one.
This is slightly left of field question, but if Compatio AI were a band, what genre of music would you be?
Ah, that's a great question. It would definitely be mostly jazz, but it would have to be somewhat eclectic. It would draw on probably a little bit of classic rock would have to be woven in there, and probably some Bob Marley-esque riffs in there as well. And some Bob Marley-esque lyrics would be woven in.
Yeah.
So I think I know the answer, but perfection or just good enough?
Definitely tending towards perfection.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so going back to the travel, you've traveled around a lot. What's your favorite country?
Where am I down?
Why, I suppose.
Well,
but you're in Scotland.
Yeah. Yeah. There's favorite country to travel to, or potentially to ultimately say, yeah, I'd like to stay there for a long haul.
Whatever you choose.
Yeah. Travel to. Yeah. I actually reached the point where I traveled so much and I thought, if I never get on a plane ever again, I'm happy. Mm-hmm. And during that era, I ended up, I went to Japan, which I loved, and I went to Australia, which I also loved. Either one of them would be probably at or near the top of the list. Lately I've been spending a lot more time in Europe, would happily go back to India. Love the UK, love being here. It just feels like home. It's like better than home. It's like the home of your home, you know, because everything is just so familiar. So yeah, I'm pretty happy wherever I am.
You were happy when we had a whiskey the other night.
Interview. Yeah, that was. Yeah, very much.
Good stuff.
Final question. So again, just thinking about the last hour, everything you've done in your career, your family, life, it's come across just how much you get behind what you believe in. So what do you love most about your business?
It's a combination of, it's intellectually enormously satisfying, because it's challenging, but yet you can, there's no end to the problems, and I love solving problems. And that was what you brought up earlier, Andy. But it's, you're solving a problem that actually has a meaningful impact on the folks that you're working with or your customers. We help them do their jobs a lot better and a lot more effectively. I'm also a gearhead. Just fascinated by anything with wheels or wings or sails or gears. So in this business running a configurator company, I have to dive way down deep and understand products that I never knew anything about, cellular networks or commercial grade padlocks or commercial plumbing fixtures or industrial automation systems. There's just no end to the cool gear that you have to learn about. Part of the reason that it needs to be B2B now is because when we had the B2C focus in the early days, I ended up buying too much stuff because of the exposure of the products. You ended up with new fly gear, right? So no, so I get to be a gearhead and solve really hard problems and deliver something of value and work with some great people and give them a path in their careers. And that's been a big part of what we want to do too. We like to give our folks a path onwards and upwards.
Well, Tim, thank you so much. You've come to the end of off the cuff there. Yeah, I think you answered them extremely well. Just really thank you again for sharing your journey. It's been really exciting, and to be involved with you as well. And the journey is just fantastic, and to hear about your background and how it's influenced where you are today. So it's thanks from me, and
it's been a delight. Yes, yeah, really nice chat.
And a pleasure to get to know you guys.
Yeah, cheers.
Thank you.